Welcome to ENCast, weekly neurology and UET talks, gastroenterology to go, the audio podcast from the European Academy of Neurology and United European Gastroenterology. This is a special episode on gastro and brain health, recorded as a collaboration between EAN and UEG.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm the editor-in-chief of e-learning of the European Academy of Neurology. In this special episode today on gastro and brain health, we are excited to collaborate with UEG Talks, Gastroenterology to Go, the GI podcast by United European Gastroenterology. My today's guest is Dr. Jutta Keller. She is gastroenterologist at the Israelitic Hospital in Hamburg in Germany and has been president of the German Society of Neurogastroenterology. I think we just start because it's not such a common subject to talk about neurogastroenterology. What is it? What is neurogastroenterology?
Neurogastroenterology is the part of gastroenterology dealing with function of the gastrointestinal tract and its regulation, which is mainly neural. We are dealing with diseases such as achalasia, for instance, gastroparesis, but also these very, very prevalent diseases such as irritable bowel syndrome and functional dyspepsia. And we are trying to explain and to find out the pathophysiology, which is, as I said, mainly neurological in many cases. Mm-hmm.
So it also involves a lot of autonomic nervous system problems, I suppose?
Yeah, it does, but also the enteric nervous system, something which most neurologists are probably not so familiar with, but this is what we suspect is the most susceptible anatomic lesion in these patients.
Is that also part of this gut-brain axis, which is often mentioned in the literature? Just in the last couple of months, I've read a lot about it and about microbiome we have to think about. And I think we neurologists really need some teaching in that.
It is the classical gut-brain axis consists of the enteric nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, and the central nervous system, obviously. But and all the connections in between are summarized as gut-brain axis. Many important diseases and prevalent diseases, such as functional dyspepsia and irritable bowel syndrome, are caused by a disturbance in this gut-brain axis. And the level of disturbance can be different in individual patients. What we know from research during the past maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years is that the microbiome also plays an important role. The microbiota influence enteric nerves and enteric function, and by now we frequently talk about the microbiome gut-brain axis, including the microbiome in this functional syncytium.
What is the relevance for functional gastrointestinal disorders?
For the past 10 years, roundabout 5 to 10 years, we actually call functional gastrointestinal disorders disorders of gut-brain interaction, which makes clear that this is the central cause of the disorders, a disturbance somewhere in the gut-brain axis. Many patients have, for instance, disorders of the enteric nervous system. They have motility disturbances resulting from neural dysregulation or secretory disturbances, and these are usually the cause of their symptoms. The disturbances may be due to some subclinical inflammation, for instance, leading to an increased inflammatory profile of mediators in the intestinal mucosa. This then leads to nerval dysregulation of nerve activity, and this is thought to be the cause of the symptoms in many patients. But there are also influences from the central nervous system, of course, something like anxiety, for instance, but also disorders of the autonomic system may modify the responses of the individual to an insult in the GI tract.
So the microbiome plays a major role. in that system. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Many investigations by now show that patients, for instance, with irritable bowel syndrome, which is the best known GIA functional disease probably, they have a different microbiome from healthy subjects. There is less variety among the species found in the large intestine, for instance, and there are also some species, but this is changing over time, which are thought to be particularly prevalent in these patients. But how the microbiome actually influences the gastrointestinal function, causes diseases, this is still a matter of investigations and of research. On the other hand, we know that by giving microbiota, we can influence GI tract function, but also some traits of mood, for instance, can be influenced by microbiota. There are studies out there showing that people feel differently on a psychological level after ingestion of microbiota.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that we can influence the microbiome with a certain diet in order to improve our brain health as well?
Diets have a huge influence on the intestinal microbiota. Even if you just change your diet for a day or two, you will find changes in the microbiota because all the different microbiomes or the different bacteria in the gut and other species, they need different kinds of nutrients for their proliferation. So diet has a huge influence. And we do use diets for treatment of functional diseases, and we think that the effect of the diets, it goes via the microbiota, via alteration of microbiota, also via a decrease in bloating, a decrease in gas production from bacteria, but that's not the only explanation for the beneficial effects of these diets.
Mm-hmm. But coming maybe back to a still healthy person to avoid functional or other gastrointestinal diseases, is there a certain diet which you can recommend to stay healthy?
Unfortunately not, no. So the risk for developing a functional bowel disorder, irritable bowel syndrome, is markedly increased by gastrointestinal infections. If you've got a viral infection, it increases maybe threefold. With a bacterial one, it increases 6 to 8-fold. And after a parasite infection, up to 40% of people develop irritable bowel syndrome. So that's something which just happens and you can hardly avoid it, not with a diet and not with probiotics, at least not certainly. But on the other hand, there are also psychological influences. These also determine whether you will develop irritable bowel syndrome after an infection. So you can do something for your health and also for avoiding irritable bowel syndrome, for instance, but diet alone won't prevent it.
Okay, good to know. So we don't have to play around too much with our food at the moment, at least not in order to avoid functional gastrointestinal disorders. But coming back to patients with neurological diseases, for example, Parkinsonian patients, but also multiple sclerosis patients, they actually often ask if they can do something with their diet to improve their health. But why do patients with severe neurological diseases frequently have major gastrointestinal complaints?
Many of the diseases or the diseases you have mentioned, they also have manifestations in the GI tract. For some, it's still not known whether they are actually the first manifestation of the disease. For Parkinson's disease, as you will know, this has been discussed in detail, and there are many studies out there trying to find out whether that's the case, or whether they are some sort of late-stage manifestation in the enteric nervous system of these diseases. We do find differences in motility, for instance, pointing to enteric neuropathy in patients with multiple sclerosis, also with Parkinson's disease. We see signs of autonomic dysfunction, of course, in patients with long-standing diabetes and autonomic neuropathy. On the other hand, all these patients take medication, which also influences the gut function or sometimes, for instance, having to take large doses of dopamine, which inhibits GI function, is no good idea actually in somebody who's also already prone to constipation. So it's usually the major problems that these patients may have are frequently multi-causal, so caused by many different problems.
Is there any recommendation from your side regarding the time of intake of these drugs, for example, if you try to avoid obstipation in Parkinsonian patients, for example?
They frequently need their specific medication several times per day, as far as I know, yeah? So you can hardly avoid it, yeah? You can hardly avoid to interfere with nutrient intake, for instance.
So, and it might not even matter. But these are questions which are commonly asked, not only by patients, but also by general neurologists, which are maybe not specialists in Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis, for example, as well. So it's a hot topic also on the patient side. They always ask for the diet if they can influence something.
Yes, it's something which they can influence themselves. So it's something which is important to them, of course. Yeah.
Coming to another topic, which also can be influenced by the patients, which we try to enforce a lot lately in Parkinsonian and multiple sclerosis and stroke patients, and every person is doing more sport. And now it will be a tricky question. I just know personally and from a lot of professional athletes, if they do long distance sports competitions, like, for example, Tour de France cycling, long distance triathlon like Ironman, you often see people, professionals as well as the amateurs, on the side vomiting or having diarrhea, which obviously hinders their performance in the competition. And what do you think is the cause of the often extensive gastrointestinal problems during these long, especially long distance sports competitions? It's not the case of obviously in short competitions up to maybe 2 or 3 hours, but everything beyond that often has a problem.
Well, the blood supply to the gut is decreased in these patients doing extensive exercise in order to get the blood to the muscles and to be able to perform. And this is, I think, the ultimate reason for the problems they have. The autonomic system will be implicated somehow because it regulates the blood supply. And so that there may be also some problems with the autonomic system, but I am not aware of any studies showing this directly.
Yeah, I've looked that up for years already and I never found anything. I just personally have the impression the autonomic nervous system might be involved, but I can't prove it so far because you don't get an athlete to do all the autonomic failure tests during a competition because that will ruin the competition. So you can't do it. And that would be interesting. I heard that before that it's mainly the blood supply problem which could cause the diarrhea.
But this is not mutually exclusive because the blood supply is regulated by the autonomic system. So if you have a marker for this, you might be able to answer the question, yeah?
Yeah, it's an just interesting practical point. Any advice for any patient with a chronic neurological disease, like we mentioned before, and Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, also after a stroke, people often suffer from constipation. Of course, they move less sometimes. Any recommendations you can give these patients or can give us what we can forward to our patients regarding the gastrointestinal tract?
First of all, of course, it's important to have a healthy diet, and it's also important to ingest fiber. But if the transit by itself does not work properly, fiber may also be problematic because they are not transported in the way we expect them to be. And for these patients, they can start early on with laxatives. Laxatives are good drugs for patients who need them. They do not cause dependency. If you need to increase the dose, it's maybe because just the problem gets worse. So that's something patients can be confident about and they do not need to fear any laxatives. There are also medications which are prokinetics, which actually improve the motor function of the gut and which we can use if laxatives aren't enough. And there are also, particularly in patients who have suffered, for instance, from a stroke or who have suffered from an injury of the spinal cord, there are also some kind of machines which increase, which work like massaging the gut, so that counteract constipation, which actually work quite well. Unfortunately, they may be expensive. They are not always covered by the health insurances. But with a combination of these, the laxatives, the prokinetics, and these external massage machines, we can help many patients.
And doing some sport, if possible, I mean, if they are not too disabled, would probably be help as well. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I have learned a lot about neurogastroenterology, which is, I think, still a kind of a new topic for most of the neurologists. You mentioned that in the beginning. Anything you want to add, which is important to know for our listeners?
Yeah, we've mainly talked about the lower part of the gut by now, about irritable bowel syndrome and constipation. But the upper part is also important, interesting. The function of the esophagus and the disturbances and the gastroparesis, which is also important in, for instance, Parkinson's disease, or maybe important. And we will have a masterclass organized by the UEG, the United European Gastroenterology Society, in October and November. It's meant for people who deal with these patients and will deal about with the pathophysiology, diagnosis and therapy of these diseases of the esophagus and the stomach. And it might be interesting for some of your listeners too.
That's great to know. Everybody who wants to know more about the topic, especially the upper gastrointestinal tract, which we didn't cover so much today, but we can have a follow-up on our today's podcast with the upper gastrointestinal tract, can obviously still sign in for the masterclass.
Yeah, and he or she will find the information that's necessary on the UG website. That's easy.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks. For me too. Bye-bye.
That's a wrap of this episode of EAN Cast and UEG Talks. We hope you enjoyed our episode today.
This has been EAN Cast, weekly neurology and UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Thanks for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for updates from the European Academy of Neurology and United European Gastroenterology. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.